This download is made possible by all the generous folks who support public radio. If that includes you, thank you. If not, become a contributing member to your local station. And now, here's the show.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry today. Thank you so much for listening. New moves from the Vatican on homosexuality and gay people, but one Catholic tells us not to read too much into it. Plus, a raucous debate in a close contest in Kentucky. We'll check in on the Senate race in the Bluegrass State. But we begin this hour with the latest in the Ebola outbreak and the American response. Since the first reported cases of Ebola in the United States, the Obama administration has announced additional screenings at five major airports, and the CDC is calling on hospitals to step up their monitoring for the virus.
Every hospital in this country needs to think about the possibility of Ebola in anyone with a fever or other symptoms that might be consistent with Ebola who's traveled to any of the three countries, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, in the previous 21 days.
It's the voice there of CDC Director Dr. Tom Frieden speaking in a press conference yesterday. Meanwhile, others are calling for an all-out travel ban for passengers, any of them, coming from West Africa. But, you know, there's a hard thing about infectious disease outbreaks. The virus isn't the only thing that's contagious. So is fear. And if fear spreads and infects too many people, that disease can be called panic. While the public demand to do more against a new threat is in some ways understandable, is having personnel in big blue spacesuits boarding planes so pictures can be posted on the internet really doing us any good? Well, Dr. Jeremy Faust says no. He's an emergency medical resident in New York, and he says that the CDC's hypervigilance under the glare of a hyperventilating media has become an overreaction. And he says the CDC doesn't need to step it up, needs to dial it back. Dr. Jeremy Faust, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You're an emergency medical physician at a hospital in New York. Your hospital asked us not to say which hospital, so we won't. We just want to get that out there. But Ebola, Dr. Jeremy Faust, is dangerous. It's running rampant in West Africa. We have our first diagnosed cases here now. Why do you think the CDC and other health authorities are overreacting?
Well, I think that it's natural to maybe have an overreaction to something that is as virulent as Ebola can be. If someone does get this virus, it is potentially very devastating, and the case fatality rates are quite high. This particular outbreak, we don't know yet how the numbers are going to play out. But in past epidemic outbreaks of Ebola, the death rate has been high. So I can understand why people are, of course, worried about this sort of thing. But there, of course, is the reality that we live very, very far away from the problem. And as of now, there are, of course, two cases we've known about in the United States, and only one has been contracted here. So while I understand the fear because it's a very scary virus to contract, I think what needs to be remembered is there's a very, very, very low chance of contracting it.
Now, we're going to talk about sort of the public perception of Ebola, maybe some of the media coverage, which I know you watch. It sounds like it really frustrates you and concerns you. But let's bring it on the ground. You work in an emergency room where there is a reaction. Resources are limited. What's been going on where you work at the unnamed emergency room here in New York that's been affected by Ebola? Why is it a problem?
Well, at the moment, it is not a problem yet, but it could become one as we get towards flu season. We're about to see a six-fold spike in the number of influenza-like illnesses in our emergency department over the next few months.
Fever, aches.
Correct. So when those people start to come in, I think that's when we're going to have a sense of, oh my goodness, we have way too many people who we can't distinguish who is who. And if every single person who came transatlantic is now fair game for these kind of screening mechanisms, we're really looking at actually resources being expended in the wrong ways.
And are you also looking at the potential for people coming in off the street for every scratchy throat and cough and fever to say, oh gosh, doc, I think I have Ebola? I mean, that takes up time and money.
Right. And it's important for people to realize that this is not an airborne virus. It can only be given, you know, from point-to-point contact, touching a mucous membrane. So you'd have to actually touch someone who you know has the virus or maybe immediate like vomit or other secretions like that and transmit that to the eyes, to the mouth. So for people to come off the street with a fear would be an overreaction to me. So that's something that we will see, and we're worried about that.
So what does it mean for you then when you hear statements like the one we played from the CDC director telling every hospital in the country to be vigilant?
Well, the CDC has a role to play, and that is to maintain this They want to control this virus, and they're doing a very nice job of that. What I'm concerned of is the optics, because the optics of this are the spacesuits and the hazmat suits, and they look like the Stay Puffed Marshmallow Man out there. But that doesn't do anything to actually help their cause. It just causes panic. So what I do understand that they need to contain this. They're doing a fine job, but I think that the optics are kind of maybe lacking.
Let's talk about sort of the media coverage of this and what you see on television and what we all see on television. There are headlines every single day. I read one just yesterday. A flight boarded after several people on board exhibited fevers. Well, it's flu season. People exhibit fevers, and they sent people in blue suits aboard a plane. I saw pictures on the internet of them getting on the plane, of them being on the plane because everybody has smartphones. What's the consequence of this?
Well, I think that the consequence is that people who have other illnesses may either not want to come and get treated because they're intimidated by what they perceive as a very dangerous situation, or on the other hand, I think people will actually on the other hand lower their bar and think, if I have a fever, I must have Ebola. So I think the problem is on both ends. We see a lot of airborne illnesses like measles and tuberculosis every year, with vaccination rates with measles being a problem. And my concern is that those are the things that we need to isolate.
What about politics in this case? It's true, of course, we understand that a concern about an outbreak like Ebola drives politicians to do things. But politics also drives the reaction to Ebola. New screening at airports, new people on hand at airports. The public wants to see a response. Cable TV wants to see a response. What's your response when you turn on cable, if you do when you're not working, and you see the coverage?
Well, the coverage really underscores the problem that everyone thinks they have to do something, and because of the political consideration, I need to look like I'm doing something, I think is the sense. And what I want to stress is that we need to not do more. We need to do the right things. And the analogy I would make would be, if you're trying to learn a complicated dance, you learn the basic steps and do those really well. Hard to do that well, but don't add other things that actually make it harder to accomplish that.
If your costume's too big, if you've got too much crazy music, you're just not going to be able to dance.
Right. So people want to look like they're proactive, like I'm doing something and it looks good for their politics, whichever side they may be on. But I actually think that those can come at a cost, because we really need to double down on the things that we know work.
The basic steps can be kind of boring and they can be kind of invisible to the television camera. But what are they?
Well, some of the things we really need to stress, and this is not just for lay people but also for healthcare professionals, would be the proper way to wash your hands, how long that lasts. 15 seconds to wash your hands is an awful long time, but people don't realize how infrequently they do it correctly. Taking on and off gloves. I was on my last shift in the emergency department. I was very cognizant of how I'm taking on and off my gloves, even though I'm not treating patients I'm worried about. And it just takes a couple of mistakes, and you realize that accidents can happen. So we really need to focus in on the simple things that we know work.
The very simple things. And public health authorities, too. You know, one number, when we look at all the numbers about Ebola, Dr. Jeremy Faust, 53,000. That's the number of Americans that died of flu and pneumonia last year. No one's boarding flights in blue suits every time somebody has a possible flu symptom.
Right. And when people ask me, how can I be safe when I go to the hospital, I sort of would say to them what I say about most low-risk scenarios like this: please wear a seatbelt on the way to the hospital, because every day thousands of people die in car accidents, but there's no national outrage about that.
So the politicians, let's say all the politicians are listening and the CDC is listening. Dr. Jeremy Faust, what's your plea?
My plea is, we as medical professionals are looked to by the public for an example, and we want to lead by example and be the rational one saying, look, we know this is a concern, but we know how to handle this, and so we're not going to do more than is necessary just because we want to look like we're doing more.
Well, the best way, according to Dr. Jeremy Faust, to keep yourself safe if you think you have Ebola and you're going to the hospital is, in fact, wear a seatbelt on the way to the hospital, because that's the thing that's probably the danger. Dr. Jeremy Faust, resident emergency medical resident physician in New York. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
In the Catholic Church, there's been a lot of expectation for reform and change as Catholics and even non-Catholics look at the relatively young papacy of Pope Francis. It seems like the Pope makes news every time he utters a phrase or makes a public gesture that appears to soften the Church's conservative centuries-old attitudes. Take, for instance, it was just a few months ago that the world took notice, especially in the United States, when Francis signaled strongly that the Church needed to be more okay with gays. If a gay person wants to come to God, Pope Francis said, then who am I to judge? Well, now it appears Francis could be taking the church a step further when it comes to its treatment of gay parishioners. A meeting of bishops this week culminated in a new statement calling for more respect for gay Catholics, especially those in committed relationships. But a changing outlook is not the same as changing doctrine or changing practice in the church. Joining us now is George Weigel, author of Evangelical Catholicism, Deep Reform in the 21st Century Church. He's also a distinguished senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Mr. Weigel, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
This statement from this group of bishops is called a relatio. It's the Latin term for it. What does it say?
It's not a statement. It's not the conclusion of anything. It's not the culmination of anything. It's an interim report on themes that have been discussed at this synod in Rome for the past 10 days. It reflects the broad range of views that were expressed at the synod. It has absolutely no legislative value whatsoever. It was deeply criticized yesterday. So there's a lot of overreacting, I think, going on here.
All right. So bring us back down to earth. I sort of said in our intro there that Pope Francis may be pushing the church to a more liberal view. Is it too early to say that?
I think what Pope Francis is trying to do is ask the church to think in a compassionate and pastorally charitable way. How do we make the truths of Catholic faith accessible to people who are living in complicated situations, which we all are? The Catholic Church is a church of sinners. Everyone in the church is a sinner. The church has understood that for 2,000 years. And the portrait that lurks behind some of the reporting today on this interim report, namely that the Catholic Church is a bunch of cranky old men, ogres, who are unwelcoming to people who are living in situations of which the church does not morally approve, is frankly slanderous. The Catholic Church, at least as I experience it, is a welcoming church. Confessional practice in the church is an exercise in compassion and mercy. It's not an exercise in bludgeoning people. So in order to understand what's going on here, I think we got to get rid of a few Catholic caricatures from our heads and understand that this Pope, who says, I'm a son of the church, I believe and teach what the church believes and teaches, is asking all of us to find ways to invite others to a deeper conversion, to a deeper appreciation of Catholic truth.
And still there can't be much doubt, it seems, even though you're sounding a note of sort of consistency and not a great deal of change, that attitudes, well, at least in the West, are changing rapidly when it comes to gay people, and that the church is reacting to that, that Francis is trying to exact a real change in the church. Everyone perceives that. Is that incorrect?
Well, the Catholic Church's view of the moral life is not composed of attitudes, Todd. It's a matter of what we believe to be truths that are embedded in human nature or revealed by God. So to talk about this as if it were some sort of psychological shift is inappropriate. I think what the Pope is trying to do is say, how do we make the truth more compelling? It does no one any good if any of us indulge, as the New York Times did yesterday, in the caricature of Catholicism as an unwelcoming, cold, inhospitable place. That is not how most Catholics experience it. And frankly, most Catholics are offended when they hear that.
There are other truths, George Weigel, of the church that maybe were more or less psychological that have changed over the last 30 years. I don't know if it was a piece of, well, it was doctrine up until, I guess, 1965, that Jews bore collective responsibility for the death of Christ, for instance. That is now no longer doctrinally acceptable in the church, but also a psychological shift. Is something similar going on here or not?
Well, first of all, it was never Catholic doctrine that Jews were corporately responsible for the death of Jesus. So that was indeed a bad attitude, a kind of culturally ingrained habit. And yes, I would say the mission of Pope Francis is to get the church to think very hard about how to teach the truth in love, how to extend compassion to people who are suffering, and how to invite everyone to a converted way of life.
What about the many Catholics who say, George Weigel, that Francis here is moving too fast in what I described as his relatively young papacy on issues of economic equality and poverty? In this case, we're talking about gay rights or divorce, that he's liberalizing a church or trying to liberalize a church too quickly. Is that the case, or is he simply reflecting a church that's open to the times?
Todd, I wrote in the Wall Street Journal last year that Pope Francis has become an enormous Rorschach blot into which people read whatever they want. And I think that's continued to this day. Pope Francis is putting items on the agenda of Catholic discussion that have frankly been talked about for a long time behind the scenes, so to speak. But he's now willing to talk about openly.
There is a place, George Weigel, where the rubber meets the road in Catholic practice, and that's communion. That is a sign of full membership, equality, member of the flock, if you will, in the Catholic Church. Is there anything in this relatio or that might come from it that indicates that people in gay relationships, gay marriages, would be able to take communion like everybody else?
I don't see it right now, because from the church's point of view, those are relationships that are not in full communion with the teaching of the church. The point of the Pope is to invite people to a deeper apprehension of truth, including moral truth. Communion is not a reward for good behavior.
George Weigel, author of Evangelical Catholicism, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Well, it was the first and only debate between Senate candidates in Kentucky. The two contestants sparred over jobs and energy and whether one of them supports Barack Obama, who's very unpopular in the bluegrass state. Democrat Alison Lundergan Grimes was pushed again on that vote in 2012, whether she voted for the president. Her opponent in that race, of course, Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader of the Senate, who's reminding Kentuckians that if he's reelected, not only will he be senator, but he stands a good chance of being majority leader. And that would be good for Kentucky. Joining us now, Philip Bailey, freelance reporter based in Kentucky, who watched last night's clash of the Senate Titans. Hi, Philip.
How you doing?
Great, and it's good to have you. The one and only debate between McConnell and Grimes, what was the major takeaway from this debate? There was a little bit of vulnerability shown from each of them, but McConnell still has a slight lead.
Yeah, I mean, the latest Bluegrass poll that was conducted here shows Grimes actually up by two, but most polls do show McConnell with a lead that's in the margin of error. So most people believe this race is still within reach and will be a horse race till the end. I think ultimately what you saw was that Grimes was much more of the aggressor. She wanted to certainly get into the senator's talking points, sort of disrupt the flow of his speeches and his campaign stunt points. I think that what Senator McConnell was trying to do is what he's been doing the entire summer, linking Grimes to National Democrats and the president, who remains even more unpopular than Senator McConnell is. Barack Obama's name is pretty much a political rock that sinks to the bottom of the ocean here.
Which isn't easy, because in Kentucky, Mitch McConnell, who's been a senator for five terms, has an approval rating of around 30%, and that's not easy to do. But let's listen to Alison Lundergan Grimes, because she has been asked over and over who she voted for in the 2012 presidential election. She hasn't wanted to say those words. Let's listen to her last night.
There's no reluctancy. This is a matter of principle. Our Constitution grants here in Kentucky the constitutional right for privacy at the ballot box, for a secret ballot. You have that right. Senator McConnell has that right. Every Kentuckian has that right.
Sounds like, and I'm sort of getting inside her head a little bit, Philip Bailey, she sounds like, I have the right not to say the words, I voted for Barack Obama.
Yeah, that gets an eye roll from even a lot of Democrats around here. The idea that this is a private matter, well, Secretary Grimes was pretty much bragging about how the fact that she was a delegate for Hillary Clinton in 2008, so that doesn't seem to be a private matter. Some Louisville Democrats have joked, is it going to be a private matter when she votes for herself, or is she going to vote for herself this coming November. It's one of those things that's surprising to me. She still hasn't been able to answer forthrightly. There's many different ways to answer it, but that shows how toxic Barack Obama is, that she doesn't even want to say his name, or yes, she voted for him. She doesn't want to talk about how maybe she didn't want to vote for John McCain for various reasons, or Mitt Romney. Senator McConnell pounced on that by saying, you know, I proudly voted for those two candidates. So the fact that Grimes cannot answer this question still remains one of those eye rolls for a lot of Democrats and a lot of fodder for Republicans. And certainly the national media is eating this up, and it shows a lack of real instincts on her part.
Now let's hear from Mitch McConnell himself telling Kentuckians, hey, I might be a lot more powerful if you reelect me.
There's a great likelihood that I will be the leader of the majority in the Senate next year. The majority leader gets to set the agenda not only for the country, but to look out for Kentucky's interest.
Now that's courtesy of Kentucky Educational Television. Before we let you go, Peter Bailey, that's Mitch McConnell's pitch, but he had some trouble of his own. He's a strong proponent of repealing Obamacare, but tens of thousands of Kentuckians have benefited from Obamacare, and it's really a national model for the expansion of Medicaid and a Kentucky health insurance system under the Affordable Care Act. It's really worked.
Yeah, this is the thing. Like, while Grimes is being ridiculed for her stumble, Mitch McConnell's stumble on the health care law here in Kentucky, where it signed up over 500,000 people, was even more astonishing. He essentially said, well, we can keep the website. I want to still repeal Obamacare root and branch, but let's keep Connect the website that people are signing up for. I think the New York Times compared it to saying, you know, let's get rid of Google, but let's keep Google.com. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to most folks. And I think that on the more substantive issue, McConnell, as Grimes said, was living in fantasy land about that. It shows how Republicans, while they attack the law, they really don't know what to do with it as more and more people are signing up. What happens to those 521,000 people, Senator? He still hasn't answered that question.
3 weeks to go before the election. That's Allison Lundergan Grimes, the challenger, and Mitch McConnell, the incumbent Republican senator from Kentucky in the marquee race. They had their only debate last night. Philip Bailey watched it for us. He's freelance reporter in Kentucky. Thanks, Philip.
Thank you, sir.
Today, President Obama, the Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Martin Dempsey, the general, and more than 20 foreign defense chiefs are going to come together to discuss coalition efforts in the ongoing campaign against the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. The meeting comes as ISIS and Kurdish forces continue to battle for control of Kobani. That's a town right on the Syria-Turkey border. And it also comes as simmering tensions between the United States and Turkey are playing out in some very strange ways. According to U.S. officials in the past few days, in public statements, Turkey says countries fighting ISIS can use its air bases to stage operations in Iraq and Syria. But Turkey says, no, you can't. David L. Phillips is director of the Program on Peacebuilding and Rights at Columbia University's Institute for the Study of Human Rights. He served as a senior advisor to the U.S. State Department under Presidents Clinton, Obama, and President Bush, and he's recently visited the Turkish border with Iraq, and he joins me now. David Phillips, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, what's the confusion over whether or not Turkey has allowed the use of the air bases? I want to play for you Dr. Susan Rice saying on Meet the Press on NBC just over the weekend that, yes, Turkey says we can. Listen.
The Turks have, this just in the last several days, made a commitment that they will, in the first instance, allow the United States and our partners to use Turkish bases and territory to train...
Airspace too, by the way?
Hold on, let me explain this carefully. To train these moderate Syrian opposition forces. So that is a new commitment that they have now joined Saudi Arabia in giving the go-ahead for that important contribution. In addition, they have said that their facilities inside of Turkey can be used by the coalition forces, American and otherwise, to engage in activities inside of Iraq and Syria. That's a new commitment and one that we very much welcome.
It's that second part, David L. Phillips, the new commitment. We can use their air bases for operations. And Turkey says that's not true, Susan Rice.
It looks like a very wobbly commitment, and it's par for the course with Turkey. They've been dragged to the altar on this deal, reluctant from the start. There have been rumors circulating for several years that the government and President Erdogan in particular have been aiding and abetting ISIS, allowing them free transit through Turkey into the battlefield. There's an ideological link between ISIS and the AK party in Turkey, so I'm not surprised that they're walking back on this deal.
And why? Is it because ISIS is fighting Assad and Erdogan and the Turkish government wants Assad out?
Turkey's motivated by two objectives. They want a regime change in Syria. They want Assad out. They also want to destroy the emergence of an autonomous Kurdish entity in Syria. They think they can achieve both objectives simultaneously, so they're linking use of their facilities with a demand for a no-fly zone and a buffer zone, the U.S. isn't going along with that project.
Now, it seems like Turkey wants a couple of things out of the United States and the coalition. They say, you can use our facilities and our help if you make your strategy what you said it was before, which is getting Assad out. But they also have a refugee problem. People fleeing ISIS and fleeing the war are flooding into Turkey, and that's a serious issue for Turkey. They want that issue resolved.
So right now Kobani is surrounded on three sides by ISIS. There is still access to Turkey through the northern part of Kobani, but that border gate is sealed. The Turks aren't letting Kurds in who want to come and join the battle, and they're not letting civilians out. That's why this proposal for a humanitarian corridor has surfaced. You know, Turkey is playing a double game here. They're looking to destroy the Kurdish autonomous entity. At the same time, they're targeting Assad, and they're willing to play ball with ISIS and these other extremist jihadi groups.
Was this part of a concern? I remember this, not this particular problem, but this general problem of Turkey having a foot in more than one camp when they joined NATO, that a lot of people in the West said, you know, it's going to come to it, and they're not necessarily going to be on the same side as other NATO countries when it comes to a Mideast conflict.
So Turkey's been a loyal and steadfast member of NATO. If there were some questions at the outset, those were addressed through Turkey's conduct and its loyalty in Korea and elsewhere. But now there are real questions about Turkey's capacity and commitment as a NATO member. The Wall Street Journal called Turkey a non-ally, and we're really looking at Turkey's reliability not only in the Middle East but also vis-a-vis Russia. If they can't be counted on in the fight against a terror group like ISIS, what happens if there's a conflagration in another part of the world where NATO is involved?
Well, Kobani is right on the Turkish border, of course. There's a fight raging there where a couple of different Turkish enemies are sort of at work there, including the Kurdish Peshmerga. But ISIS has said publicly that Turkey is their next target. Is that a credible threat?
ISIS has already attacked Turkey. A year ago in Hatay province, there was a bombing for which ISIS took credit. So it is a credible threat that ISIS would expand its operations, but probably through terrorist activities. There's a battalion of Turkish tanks parked on the border. It's not likely that ISIS is going to want to confront them directly.
Right. Turkey is not a weak state, and it certainly does not have a weak army like Iraq.
Second largest army in NATO.
Right. So the threat is not an existential one, if I can use that word that's getting tossed around, but one where ISIS could antagonize Turkey with terrorist acts and other things like that if they wanted to.
There's also a fifth column within Turkey. You've got an Islamist government and Islamic radicals within Turkey that want to target the regime for being too soft on ISIS. So Turkey has put itself between a rock and a hard place. It needs to clearly take a stand. And the U.S. also needs to be clear on commitments. You know, if we want to confront ISIS effectively, we need to know who our friends are. In Iraq and in Syria, the Kurds have shown that they are reliable and capable. If we want to narrow the space under ISIS control, the way to do that is by working with a moderate Syrian opposition. We don't know who those opposition figures are, but we do know the Kurds in Syria and Iraq can be a reliable ally.
Well, David L. Phillips, there's no question the relationship here as it comes into the light of day with Turkey is problematic on this issue. You know, do we need them? I mean, in the age of aircraft carrier groups and cruise missiles and drones, certainly. Look, we're not putting troops on the ground in Syria or Iraq. The president has made that clear, at least not troops that are visible. So if it's all about airstrikes for at least our end of this thing, do we really need Turkey to give us air bases?
So operationally and functionally, we really don't need Turkey. If Turkey withdraws from the coalition, it sends a signal to other countries that we're recruiting to get on board, that they too can withdraw and there won't be a price to pay. So it's more symbolic and political than practical.
What we need is a moderate Muslim-friendly country to join our side of the fight clearly and make that a big billboard, right?
Turkey used to play that role, but under President Erdogan, it's become an Islamist state. It no longer is the moderate secular republic that we knew in the past.
And now the Saudis, in a way, are playing that role. That's kind of interesting.
We don't have many friends in that part of the world, and our friends are pretty shallow, few and far between.
David L. Phillips is director of the Program on Peacebuilding and Rights at Columbia University's Institute for the Study of Human Rights. He was a former advisor in the State Department to several presidents, Obama, Clinton, and Bush, and has joined us to give his views on Turkish reluctance to join the coalition and give airspace and air bases to the United States in its fight against ISIS. Thank you.
Thank you.
So back to the conversation you're having with us about faith and religion. Has religion brought your family together or driven them apart?
My name is Jenny, and I'm calling from North Carolina. I have a very simple belief. God is love. And when God is present, love is present. And when love is present, God is present. Yet I was married to a man who became a pastor after we married, and his self-absorption with his calling was a factor in our marriage failing. My faith that love conquers all did not happen in my own marriage. Go figure.
And from Sonoma, California, this: my devout Christian parents can't reconcile their love for their son, who is gay, and the edict from their church. I've since turned my back on their faith and most of my family. In my eyes, religion has done nothing but been a detriment.
I was raised in a devoutly Christian home. My mom was a children's pastor for the Assemblies of God. My dad was on the church board. It was a small church, a community church of about 200 people. When I wasn't at home, I was always at church, and I loved it. It felt like a big family to me. Eventually, we all grew up, went our separate ways, as life will take you to, some of us to college, some of us, you know, moving away, having families of our own. I ventured into being a pastor myself, but eventually left the faith over disagreements in doctrine. Nowadays, I consider myself a spiritual agnostic, but I still love listening to my mom talk about the Lord. Those feelings of safety and belonging that I felt in my childhood return again, reminding me that the simple things of faith, hope, love, and forgiveness bind us together, even in our differences.
That's Jason from Texas. You can give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. Hocktober continues tomorrow. John will be back. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Moo.com, offering business cards with Printfinity, the option for a different image on every card in a pack. More at Moo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.